Hello, and welcome back to another episode of the 343 Podcast. My name is John Peronich, and I am your host. And today, I'm super excited to tell you about this very special episode. My guest is former U.S. Men's National Team head coach, Bob Bradley. Now, a friend of mine, Levy Bird, helped me connect with Bob via email. After a few weeks of short messages and trying to lock down a date and time, Bob and I finally linked up on Skype and spent about an hour discussing some of the major events that have happened during his coaching career. It was mid-morning here in California where I'm from, and it was early evening in France where Bob had just returned home from a preseason training session. The interview starts off kind of awkwardly, and I feel like I say this all the time. There's always something that goes wrong, whether it's the recording thing didn't work or I haven't figured out how to use my sound equipment, blah, 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 blah. I'm sorry, but yes, again, this interview starts off kind of awkwardly. I usually conduct some sort of short pre-interview with all of my guests before we actually start recording. I always ask a few warm-up questions to check the audio levels and get a feel for what kind of mood they're in, and I always ask if there are any topics that are off limits. Well, as you'll hear, Bob just jumps right into the thick of things with detailed answers to some of my warm-up questions. So we never really did a pre-interview, but instead of slowing him down, I just let it go, and Bob just kept flowing. And before I knew it, we were talking about the violence and protests happening in Egypt during his time as a head coach for their national team, and we were knee-deep into what it was like to be eliminated by Ghana as the coach of two different nations in two major international tournaments. The conversation eventually cycled back to square one when I asked Bob if he had always been a leader, and we talked a bit about his formative years. And towards the end of the conversation, he gives some great advice for all aspiring coaches. Now, like I said, this is a special episode to me. I never thought I'd get the chance to interview someone like Bob. And the goal for this podcast is to keep building and to keep growing. So if you're wondering how you can support this podcast, here's a couple different ways. Obviously, listen to the show, and you can share it on social media or with friends or fellow coaches. Now, that's the easiest way. The second way is to sign up for our free or premium online coaching memberships at 343coaching.fm. That's the number 3, the number 4, the number 3, coaching.fm. Now, this is where over 1,000 coaches are currently enrolled and learning our methodology right now. If you're already a 343 premium member, I highly recommend signing up for the free course just as a refresher. And if you're new to us, hello and welcome. But I definitely recommend signing up for the free course and seeing what we're all about. Once you've digested all of our free material, then go ahead and join us in the premium membership program where you'll get access to videos, ebooks, audio, and networking opportunities in the coaching forums. So once again, that way to help support this podcast is by going to and signing up at 343coaching.fm. That's the number 3, the number 4, the number 3, coaching.fm. All right, with that, we're going to get right into my conversation with Bob Bradley. Thank you for listening and enjoy. I wanted to just do a little pre-interview with you. I meant to send you some questions, but because we'd never really locked down a date and time, I failed to do that. So, I guess, first off, thank you. And what I really kind of wanted to focus on is, your formative years, how you got into, U.S. soccer and the days or the years leading into, your first coaching jobs and whatnot. I believe Princeton was your first head coaching job.
Actually, Ohio University was. Ohio, so.
Okay, so I'm missing one. Okay, so I mean, I definitely want to talk about.
I mean that's pretty easy for me. I mean, the bottom line is, when I got out of Princeton, I was hoping to play, but there weren't great opportunities. Honestly, I wasn't a great player, and my first year out of school, I worked. And I was still playing on different teams and trying to play as many games as I could. And then I had a chance to go to Ohio University and get a master's in sports administration, but more importantly, coach their team. And So I was 22 years old, and I had Ohio University has a large international population. So I had an Algerian assistant coach, and I had players from Iran and Iraq and Lebanon. And I had a chance to take my ideas that I always had as a player and try to figure out where they fit coaching wise. So learning on the fly, and from that moment on, I've coached every year since. So that was the fall of 1981.
So you've always had like a connection to Middle East or that region.
I mean, it's sort of ironic that, you know, I did in my first year, and then when I finished at Ohio and went on with other things, I didn't really have that kind of a connection. But then when I was finished with the U.S., that's when the whole idea of going to Egypt came up. They were familiar with me through the fact that we were in the same group in Confederations Cup, and, you know, on and on. So, you know, I touched on it in 1981, and then ended up jumping back into it in 2011. So it shows you how it works.
Did anything? I know it's kind of a random connection, it seems like, with a lot of space in between. But did anything from 1981 help connect the job with Egypt?
No.
Or did anything that you learned from in 1981 help at all with Egypt?
No, I had some Muslim players, so you know, I when we first when I first went out there, they were in Ramadan, and so I had some experience with that, but certainly there was nothing more. And you know, the other experience for me, which was really important, going to Egypt and when I was there, was that during my one season at Chivas USA and then my 5 years with the U.S. National team, Zach Abdel, Egyptian-American, was my goalkeeper coach. You know, and Zach, he lives in La Vergne, California, but he had been in the U.S. for a while. He had been an assistant, the goalkeeper coach at the Galaxy. He was instrumental in developing Kevin Hartman and Matt Reese. When I went to Chivas, then he played a great role with Brad Guzan. And then he was with the U.S. team, and then he was with me in Egypt. So that certainly helped.
I'm super curious about your time in Egypt. I remember at the time, there was a lot of turmoil in that region, and Arab Spring, and a lot of political activity happening, and you were kind of right in the thick of things. And I'm really curious how that was for you being there, and how as an American did that feel to be there? I don't know how to frame that question the right way.
Yeah.
I struggled writing that down, but it's something I really want your opinion about.
Yeah, I mean, it was from the time that Zach and I first went there to talk about the job. I went back a second time on my own. I knew it would be a challenge, but an incredible experience. And the goal for Egypt was the World Cup, and got there, and it was maybe 9 months after the revolution, and was trying to get a feel for the culture and the football and everything. And then a few months later was Port Said, and then that changed everything. So, you know, it was, I mean, from a personal standpoint, my wife and I never felt in danger. You had to be smart. You had to be aware in terms of where you went, when you went, that kind of thing. But Egyptian people are incredible, and they're welcoming. And if you're there and they think you're there to do something that's good for their country, they will never forget that, and they appreciate it. And my experience with the players was absolutely fantastic. I still hear from many of them. I hear from El Nene and Salah and Hegazi and Abu Trik and these guys every few weeks. I have nothing but good feelings about the work with the players. It was great. The only disappointment is we come so close and didn't make it.
What you said the goal for Egypt was to win the World Cup, and I have a strong feeling that's obviously the goal for
to get to the World Cup.
I see.
Egypt had this incredible run of success in the African Cup of Nations. But Egypt hadn't qualified for a World Cup since 1990. And when they failed to qualify for the African Cup of Nations early in 2011, then they decided at some point that it was time to make a coaching change. And they thought, they had in the past some experience with foreign managers. And my name was presented, and based upon the work with the U.S., based upon the fact that we were in the same group in the Confederations Cup, and we beat them, obviously, in the third match to advance out of our group before we played Spain, they asked if I would come and talk to them. And so they said at the time that, we've had this success in the African Cup of Nations, but more than anything now, the goal is the World Cup. And everywhere you went from the day I got there, people would say, Kas Alam, that's how they say World Cup in Arabic. Kas Alam was some of the first words I learned. And they would say, we must go to the World Cup. Kas Alam, we must go to Brazil. So it was the goal. And as I said, when the tragedy took place in Port Said, the league stopped. For the most part, the players weren't getting paid, but there was still this idea that maybe we could figure out how to get to the World Cup. So there was never a question of leaving. And the players' response during those difficult times was incredible. I mean, they'd come into camp so motivated, so excited. A few 4 months after Port Said, we played our first World Cup qualifiers. We won a fantastic game in Guinea. After beating Mozambique at home, we played in an empty stadium because they wouldn't allow fans. So, I mean, we used the goal to try to unite a team. And in that regard, it was incredible. But in the final round when we drew Ghana, the first match was just a day when everything possible went wrong.
During that time, so the league is basically on strike and the players aren't getting paid. As a national team coach and I'm assuming as a public figure, I mean, people are looking to you saying World Cup, World Cup, World Cup. They know who you are and they know what the goal is.
Yep.
What do you do during that time, or what did you do during that time for the players, or what were you saying to the people that were coming to you with this plea of get us to the World Cup?
In addition to Zach Abdel, I had a great assistant named Dia El Said. Dia had been the under 20 coach before I got there, and we knew that we weren't always going to get the support we needed from the federation, but we used every contact. And Dia, I used to joke all the time that without Dia, this thing had no chance, because he knew certain people. We'd figure out ways that we could bring players in for camps. We couldn't play any matches at all in Egypt. We dealt with match promoters that would then set up matches. We played in Abu Dhabi. We played in Dubai. We played in Khartoum, Sudan. We played in Tripoli, Lebanon. We went anywhere where we could get games. And we used that whole time to start to bring young players into the national team. That was the first real experience for a lot of the U-20s that he had, which included Salah and El Nene and Hegazi and Omar Gaber and these guys. And we started using that time to build our team. And we would say to the players throughout those days in those camps that in June we have a World Cup qualifier, and on that day we're going to put 11 on the field, and they're going to put 11 on the field, and the ref's going to blow the whistle, and then it's on us because nothing else will matter. It won't matter whether there was a league or anything. So we have to find a way to be ready for it. And the credit always goes to the players, because there are so many things that they could have had on their minds that they could have allowed to get in the way, but that was never the case.
What would you say your biggest success was during your time in Egypt?
Our football was very good. We built a team that was strong and united. We introduced young, important players to the national team. And we played football that made people proud, that people were excited about. And unfortunately, again, the way qualifying in that cycle worked, in the second round, you were in a group of four teams, and you had to win your group. So we were in with Mozambique, Guinea, and Zimbabwe. And we won all six matches. We were the only team in Africa to win all six matches in that round. And there were 10 group winners. And then they made two pots. And we were hoping that we would be in pot one, because with the undefeated record in qualifying, we thought that might do it. But they still went by FIFA rankings. Somehow Tunisia ended up ahead of us, in part because our FIFA ranking dropped when we weren't playing as many official matches because of Port Said. And so we ended up sixth, but that put us in pot two. And now they start drawing, and we end up with Ghana. And in the first game we played in Kumasi, and we went with confidence, and we went with the idea that this was going to be our time to get to the World Cup. And literally the kickoff, and we played back to our center back, who was one of our most experienced players, Wal Goma. Great guy, played for Ali, had played in many African club championships. And he played a ball into the midfield to Nene, and it turned over. And literally, after 11 seconds, Ghana got a great chance. And you could almost see that at that moment, the tremors started. And I really felt the only game that I could ever remember that I saw a similar thing happen was when Brazil played Germany in the World Cup and lost 7-1, where you just felt like the Brazilian players, there was so much pressure that they just weren't themselves. And that day in Kumasi, there were many factors. The field was tough. Honestly, the refereeing on that day was not what we would have wanted. But in the end, the pressure that was on our players on that day, they just weren't themselves. So we lost 6-1. It was catastrophic in every way. It's interesting that there was... there's been some reports, and you know how the press in Africa is, but there's reports out of Africa in the last couple of weeks saying that that there was money from the Ghanaian Football Federation that was paid out, and no records that in with regard to the Egypt game. So there's speculation that there was wrongdoing, but how would you know? And then in the return leg, we won 2-1, but obviously the 7-3 aggregate, and we won 7 of 8 World Cup qualifiers, but didn't manage to get to the World Cup.
And when you're preparing for Ghana, you had already done this for the United States. You'd already gone through the scouting process and the researching the team and preparing a team for a game against Ghana. What did you do differently, or what did you take from that time that you had that experience with the United States into your match with Egypt?
Yeah, our U.S. team and our team in Egypt were very different. Certainly the experience of preparing for Ghana, knowing all their players, in Rustenburg, I really felt on the night with the U.S. team that we were the better team. We gave up the early goal. We pushed incredibly hard. We got a goal 1-1. And when there was 30 minutes left in regulation, I think we thought the game was ours. We had some chances. It goes to extra time. And, we give up a goal again early in extra time. And it's like we went to the well once too often. But, again, now the physical qualities of the players from Ghana, the idea that, they had players that on their own that could make chances, somebody like Asamoah Gyan, who hurt us with the U.S. team, and then in Kumasi was an important player for him. These are players that when you prepare your team, you try to get across the idea that they can be out of a game for 20 minutes, 30 minutes, not look interested, but they are players that at any moment physically can take a play and do something special. So your concentration has to be at the highest level. You play those teams and you feel like, football wise, you can still in stretches dictate the terms of the game. You can still have control, but the second you lose the ball, if your reactions aren't good, if in any way you're caught out of position, then they have players that in that moment can punish you. And actually, in that regard, that ended up being part of the undoing in both games.
I asked you what you felt like your biggest success was during your time in Egypt, and I'm really curious what you feel like your biggest success was during your time with the U.S. men's national team. Is there a moment or a game or maybe a period of time that just really stands out as that was what we were about when I was the coach?
There were many games, but again, when you begin a cycle, then the message is that every time we come together, the way we talk to each other, the environment, the way we work, the kind of football we want to play, we've got to establish all of this, and we've got to build something so that when we get to the World Cup, we have something. It's not like you can just get there and then flip a switch. And in the early part of the cycle in 2007 and 2008, we were trying to reestablish an idea that any team that played against the U.S., that we were going to be hard to play against, that we wanted first to make sure that there was some structure, that on the field, that our collective idea was strong. And then as that was building, then we started to make sure that our football ideas when we had the ball were good. How could we create chances? We felt with that team oftentimes that if we tilted Clint and Landon off to either side, that as we started to play, the ability for them to come into inside a little bit and for our midfielders, for Michael, for Ricardo Clark, for Moadu, for these guys to be able to play through the lines and find those guys in good attacking positions with guys like Josie or Charlie Davies in front of them, with outside backs coming up on the outside, that this put our most creative players in good position to make a difference for our team. And I think as we began to grow, we had confidence and certainly the Confederations Cup for all of us was special. We you know, we lost the first two games, tough games, Italy and Brazil. We had red cards in both. We knew that we still had a chance, but it was going to take a big win against Egypt. We pushed from the get-go and won 3-0 and of course, needed some luck. And when we were getting ready for Spain, you know, we had played them the year before in a friendly in Santander and lost 1-0 on a late goal. And we knew that when you play Spain that no matter who you are, they're going to have the ball more. But we talked about how we could still, when we had the ball, make them defend. We made sure that Charlie Davies and Josie understood that that your speed and your physical qualities can still put defenders like Piqué and Puyol under pressure. We talked about the fact that when we had the ball, that you know, we still needed to play and have confidence. And you know, I can remember saying that there's a lot of teams that play Spain, and you know, possession might be 70-30. Look, you can't worry about possession, but can we make it 60-40? Can we make it 55-45? Can we make sure that when we have the ball, they have to defend? And then when we lose the ball, can we make sure that when Xavi gets it, that he's got to play square and backwards, that he can't just play balls forward so easily, and that in the center of the field, how could we keep things tight? So, you know, we had an idea, and we went into that game with a belief that look, if we play the way we're capable of, then yes, we can win. And obviously, for all of us, that is still a special night in Bloemfontein. If you look at the success that group of players had in Spain, 2008, 2010, 2012, the idea that we could beat them in a Confederation Cup semifinal in 2009 says a lot. And then over the next year, we continued to build, and obviously we won our group. And when we went into that Ghana game, we believed that there was more there for us, that this was a World Cup where we could go far. And I remember my words. I remember saying to the players that you can't lose track of the fact that you still have to earn it, you know, minute by minute, half by half, that, you know, you can't get ahead of yourselves, that we're a team that if we concentrate and we play our football and everything, we can continue to show people how good we are. And, you know, when we got knocked out of that World Cup, it was incredibly disappointing. Like I said, every one of us felt there was more there for us. But we were also quite proud of what we were all about. I mean, it was a World Cup where it's just the way football works sometimes. You have to play from behind. We never gave up. We pushed games when we were behind. We knew how to play on the edge. We knew how to push forward. I mean, anybody who watched the second half of the game against Slovenia, a team that beat Russia in the playoff to get to the World Cup, a team that hadn't given up any goals in the World Cup qualifying. And now in the second half of the game against Slovenia, when we had to really play on the edge, still have structure, but take chances, go forward when we lost the ball, work to win it back, play as high up the field as we could. We changed formations a few times in the second half. We went to three in the back. You know, those are not things that you just think of at the moment and then try. Those are things that in the course of 4 years in training sessions and on different days you work through. So, you know, we had a team that never gave up. I thought we played good football. And then I stayed around for one more year. And our idea was to continue to grow. You know, part of trying to make our football better included now seeing if we introduced some new players, if we had possibly some guys, some young defenders that also were a little more comfortable with the ball. You know, we in 2009 and 2010, Oguchi Onyewu, Carlos Bocanegra, and Jay DeMeritt were very important players for us. I've said many times that, you know, you'd go on the field against big teams, and every one of those guys, as they were walking out of the locker room, would look at you and give a little smile like, Ibrahimovic, Luis Fabiano, no problem, I'm ready. And that's first and foremost. When you have a national team and you're playing against these kind of teams, you got to have defenders who can defend. But as you grow, you also hope that you can begin to also have defenders that are that much more comfortable with the ball. Now, every one of those guys I felt improved a great deal playing out of the back. I mean, Jay DeMeritt, when I first saw him at Watford, the teams that he played on never played out of the back. They played balls long and moved up the field. And then Maki McKay came in as coach. They began to change a little bit. Jay came into our national team camps. And all of those guys understood that look, we have to have some ability to play from the back. We have to have some ability to play the right pass into the midfield. So for me, all those guys made great progress. But we had ideas then after the World Cup that we could grow in different ways. We worked on, in the middle of the field, how we could rotate a little bit more and find space and maybe in different situations have a little more fluidity. And so we had different ideas. And we played a lot of good teams between 2010 and 2011. When I got fired, they said to me, well, the results were no good. And I said, well, let's talk about results. Because we had played Poland with Lewandowski and with Kuba and with Piszczek and all these guys. We had played Colombia with Falcao and many other big players. We had played a very good Paraguay team, Tata Martino coach. We played them in Nashville. We lost 1-0, but I thought we played really well on the day. And so, you know, as we got to that Gold Cup, we still felt that our football was going in a good direction. And ultimately, as we prepared for the final against Mexico, we knew that in the Rose Bowl that night was going to be a crowd mostly Mexican. But we felt that we were ready to try to step up and play in their end and push the game and make sure that it wasn't a game where Mexico had the ball the whole time. And, you know, it's an interesting thing in the U.S. because when you lose to your arch rival, when you're ahead 2-0 and then it's 2-2 at half and then you lose 4-2, the knives come out. A lot of people say this is four straight goals and this is terrible and everything. Never mind that in one of the best games I saw this year, Juventus gave up four straight goals to Bayern. It's football sometimes. And if you're willing to play the best teams and if you're willing to try to step up and play in their end, then, you know, sometimes that's how you learn. And I thought the Gold Cup final in 2011 was a great game. When it was 3-2 Mexico, we hit the crossbar. The response from too many people was time for a change. And so for me, that was the last one. So if you had to go out, it went out in a final, went out on a game that I still, I tell many people, if you want to sit and watch that game with me, no problem. Because as much as we lost, as disappointing as it was, that was a great final. That was a great game. It was a great Mexican team. So, you know, for me, I've never looked back on that part of it because I always felt that football-wise, we were trying to push things, continue to move forward, and continue to try to be the best team we could.
Now, you hit the nail on the head, like saying in the court of public opinion, the knives are going to be brought out, and there's nothing that you as a coach can really do about that. But when you look back on your time, and maybe not just specifically with the national team, the U.S. national team. Maybe it's with Egypt or where you're at now or in the past. Where do you get critical about your coaching performances or your team's performances. Which moment stands out to you as maybe the biggest failure?
Every time you feel like you're moving a team forward and you get to a big game, and then on the day it's not quite enough, then you recognize that you know what, it wasn't good enough today in some way. So for me, you go back to the World Cup in 2010, and we fought like crazy to get out of our group, and I felt like Ghana was there for us, but we made some mistakes, and as hard as we pushed, we couldn't make up for those mistakes. When we played Mexico, that was at a time when we had brought Jermaine Jones into the team, and we were still trying to figure out when you had Jermaine and Michael on the field together, how to balance the responsibilities. And Michael, during that stretch, was a very strong two-way player for us. He would be back deep, but then he would get forward. He would help score some goals, create some goals. And so the first thought with Jermaine is that Jermaine was probably more number six. But as we went through the Gold Cup, you couldn't I wasn't sure what the best way. And so when I look back on the Mexico game, if I had that to do over again, I think I would have said, look, in the responsibilities between the two of you, Michael, you be the one to hold things together a little bit more. And you play a little more in the Xabi Alonso role. Let's let Jermaine be a little more free to run and push, and let's do it that way. I can think of little details like that. When we lost this heartbreaking game in Kumasi, we during that period of time with Egypt, when we would play against some of the very athletic African teams, we still felt that our football could be different. That Egyptian team was very good with the ball. Abitreka was a very special player. And maybe in that first game, we could have set ourselves up a little more defensively. Now, we didn't play in a foolish manner, but you know what? If I had to do that again, maybe I could have found a little more balance in the game. We made some changes throughout, but you look back and think, the pressure was going to be great that day, and maybe we needed to just be a little bit stronger defensively and make sure that as the game developed that we were keeping things close. So, you look back on little things like that, but the preparation of those games, the kind of football that all those teams played, the work and training to establish a identity and a mentality and work on our football, those things never changed. I always feel good about that.
Real quick, Bob, I want to find out how much time you have left with me.
What do you need? 10 minutes?
Whatever you're willing to give me, man. I could ask questions all day, but
how about 10 to 15 minutes?
Okay, let's go for it. Have you always been a leader? And I'm not just referring to coaching, but maybe like in your upbringing, were there any moments as a kid or as a young adult where you kind of knew that you were going to be in a coaching or teaching career?
In my house, leadership came from the top, from my dad. Three boys, my dad was a Marine. He was in Korea. He never talked about his war experiences. He was there when he was 18 years old. But in our house, he made sure that things were done the right way. He made sure that there was love and respect, and he knew what it meant to make sure that things were done right. So that was first. Then for me, I was lucky. I played different sports. I played for different coaches, and they many of them instilled the idea that you know, if you're going to be an important player, then when you're on the court, you have to be a leader. You have to think about the team. You can't just think about what's good for you. And you know, I took all that in, and then as time went on, I've been able to watch other good coaches, not only in football, but in other sports. I've learned from that, but you know, there's a part of it that also it just comes. It's who you are, and then you know I can. I'm not going to name names, but you know I can remember when I played in college. One of my good friends was a guy that in the off season, some of the other guys that he hung around with, they would smoke a little marijuana, and I can remember saying to my friend one time, "Listen, out of curiosity, when does this end? Are you going to be 40 years old and married and have kids, and this is still going to be something you're going to do? Or is this going to be part of your youth, and at some point you're going to say, you know what, okay, it was no problem, but now I'm done with that." And you know, I tell the story because there was something in me as a 20-year-old that could look at my friend and tell him something that none of his other friends would tell him. And, you know, I didn't tell him to be a jerk, but I told him because it made sense to me. And so, you know, this idea that when you have friends, they're not just your friends because you tell them what they want to hear, and they tell you what you want to hear, that you look at them and you try to help them, you try to challenge them. And so, you know, there was some part of that coming from my dad, and then as I went through the teams I played on, that part came naturally. And as I said, I wanted to play, but there weren't the best opportunities. And then from a young guy, you start coaching. And so, you know, if you do the math, I think that means that for me, it's 36 years, I think. And so, you know, I was 15 years in college soccer. During that time, I was also coaching kids. I was coaching club teams. I was coaching ODP teams. I coached some youth national teams. So I was doing anything I could to be involved in the game. And then starting with the league and the Olympic team in 96, I've been a professional coach since. And, you know, even last year, my second season in Norway, you know, we started preseason in 2015 on January 5th in Norway. And even with the weather, we trained outside all the time. And you know, we made it to the semifinal of the Cup. We had friendly matches. We played our 30 league matches. We sold a couple players. I think that year in Stabæk, we brought in like 4.5 million euros. I took the UEFA course, finished my UEFA Pro. I did presentations for the Scottish Federation and for the Danish Federation. And then when the season ended in Stabæk and we had qualified for Europa League, the next day I spent my time with the people in the club and with the players because they knew I was leaving. And the next day, my wife and I flew to France. And then the following day, I was on the training field in Le Havre. And, you know, you get on the field. Whenever I go into these situations, actually before you go on the field, people say, you know, what do you say to the team? And I've found that in every situation, when I get there, I sort of say the same thing. I say, I didn't arrive here with all the answers, but I come here to get to know you and for you to get to know me. I want to make you better. And when we work to make you better, then we're going to figure out how to make a good team. And so to begin with, let's get started. And so you just lay some starting points, and then it's through the work every day. It's through the things you see on the training field. It's through video. It's through one-on-one discussions that now you start to engage people. You start to find ways to see how they think and figure out which ones can understand little details on how they can improve and which ones want to get better and which ones don't and which ones will give anything for the team and which ones only care about themselves. And so, you know, I still go into every situation and roll up my sleeves and off we go. So here I am now. We've just been through preseason. We start our schedule this Friday, and we're trying to see if we can build on last year and become a better team.
What's been your most exciting moment in France so far?
My most exciting moment was, again, total heartbreak, but it's football. As we came down the stretch last season, our football had gotten much better, and we were one of the teams fighting for the third spot for promotion. And in the final weeks of the season, it was between us and Metz. And, you know, Metz was going through a stretch where a lot of things were going their way. The third to last game, we beat Nîmes at home 3-1. Everybody in France thought Metz would lose at Dijon because Dijon was still fighting for the championship. And on that day, Metz wins 4-0 at Dijon. So when we get to the final game, we know we have to make up goals. And so the games roll at the same time. Early in the Metz match, Lens takes the lead 1-0. And now we're pushing against the Borg Personas. And in the 40th minute, we go up 3-0. And 3 minutes later, our young striker, who in the meantime has been sold for 7.5 million euros to Bournemouth, goes in on goal all by himself, and he shoots, and he hits the left post. It bounces across the goal. It hits the right post, and it bounces straight back to the keeper. So at halftime, it's 3 instead of 4. We make it 4-0 in the 67th. We make it 5-0 in the 83rd. Meanwhile, we're getting reports that Lens is pushing, but still only 1-0. And in the end, we win 5-0. Lens wins 1-0. We tie with Metz on points. We tie goal differential. And they've scored 2 more goals than us, so we don't get promoted. So that was my most exciting and most disappointing moment. We had an incredible crowd that night. Everything about our team, the connection with the supporters, the way we played the football, was something that I was very proud of, but somehow we missed. And I have a young friend. He was assistant coach with me in Egypt, and then also for the first year in Norway, named Tomek Keshmark. And Tomek is Polish, but grew up in Germany and is actually now taking the UEFA Pro course in Germany. And Tomek that night reminded me that Jurgen Klopp, when he was at Mainz, one season missed out on promotion by a point, and then the next season they missed out by a goal, and then the third season they went up. So in a weird way, it puts a smile on your face, because as bad as you feel, you know, it's happened to people before you.
How do you come into this season after the excitement and then the heartbreak at the end of last season, how do you use that to fuel your players? What's your message to the players now as you're getting ready to start this new league?
Well, we talked about it at the end of last year, that we had grown as a team, that we had a lot to be proud of, but that everybody had to understand that when you start from scratch the next season, there's a lot more work to be done. And anybody involved in football knows that from one season to the next, especially in clubs like Loab, you don't keep all your players. So, you know, I mentioned the young striker. When I arrived in Loab last year, Lise Musset, in the first 14 games before I arrived, had played 100 minutes and had scored one goal. And the first question that they asked me was whether I thought he should go out on loan. And I said, well, let me have a few days to watch him and get to know him. And a few days later, I went back to the president and said, I think he's our best striker. I want to keep him. And so in the last 24 games of the season, Lee scored 13 goals. By the end of the season, there were 25 or 30 scouts from many, many countries, clubs here. And then as much as we didn't want to sell him for a club like Loav, 7.5 million euros, ends up being a lot of money. And so now we're trying to also figure out how to add to our team. So you go through the preseason, you work with the group you have, you try to pick up on where you left off in terms of our football, how we play, what happens when we have the ball, reactions, how do we create chances, every part of the game. But then you also, at the same time, are spending a great deal of time and energy looking at players, hoping that we can still add a few. So we're in that period as we speak, but we also know that they start counting points on Friday.
Now, obviously, you're extremely focused on your upcoming season, and I wish you, of course, the best of luck for that. But do you ever see yourself coming home to coach again? Do you ever see yourself back on our side of the pond?
Yes. Look, I'm a product of the game in the U.S., but I'm also a product of looking for challenges and not being satisfied with where I am. I think every player that I've ever coached knows that I've challenged them in the same way in their life and in their careers. So it's been important for me to try to push out of the comfort zone in different ways and to, I still say, to prove myself, to show people my work and see what type of opportunities come. I think starting from the time when I was the U.S. coach and we played games in Europe, you know, I've been fortunate. Many opposing coaches, many opposing players let me know what they thought of our team and how impressed they were. Same happened with Egypt. I've coached a lot of big players. And so, you know, I've been lucky that I've had experiences that have helped push me in this direction. And now we'll see. We'll see what kind of opportunities come up. But at a certain point, in the right situation, in a club in the U.S. that still is motivated to do things the right way, that understands how to connect things that you're doing in the academy and with your young players, with the first team, and has an understanding that team that steps on the field has to have an identity with the city and has to have a connection with the supporters, have to have the right stadium, have to have all these things. And if in the right situation, enough of those things make sense, and you have people who share that kind of vision, then yeah, I'm always up for working with good people. So you never know.
Bob, I'm incredibly impressed by your optimism and your positive outlook with all the stories you've told us today, and I want to say thank you for the sacrifice that you've made as a national team coach. I know it's not easy on a person and on your family, and it sounds like you guys are enjoying your time around the world. And yeah, with that, thank you. Maybe if you have a message or a few last words for listeners. I mean, most of us are here in the United States, so anything you'd like to leave listeners with?
Sure. I'll speak to coaches, and I'll make sure that they all know that regardless of where I've been, I'm still one of you. And every time you step on the field with a group of players, you have the chance to turn that training session into something special, to bring it to life, to give it energy, to give it tempo, purpose, and most of all, to make sure that football happens. And so that's still the part I love the most. And I send my best to all coaches in the U.S. with the idea that that's the part that all of us share, and enjoy the game and give everything you have to the players that you work with.
Bob, an incredible interview, and I thank you so much. Thanks for coming on the show and being super generous with your time as well.
Good, John. All the best, my friend.
All right, that was my episode with Bob Bradley. Again, this was a very special episode to me, and I am very, very thankful that Bob took time out of his busy schedule to have a conversation with me. And like I mentioned at the top of the show, if you're looking for ways to help support this little podcast and help it grow and build into something much bigger, you can do a couple of different things. So please, if you can, if you're nice enough to do so, share this episode on social media with your friends, with your family, with your players, with other coaches. That would be amazing and much appreciated. The other way that you can help support this podcast is by visiting 343coaching.fm. That's the number 3, the number 4, the number 3, coaching.fm. And you can sign up for one of our two coaching courses that we have there. So one is free, one is premium, and they are both loaded with a ton of value. So 343coaching.fm. That's the number 3, the number 4, the number 3, coaching.fm. With that, I will say adios, and I will see you guys all next time. Thank you.